Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today, David Baldacci. We'll be discussing Mr. Baldacci's newest novel, The Camel Club, which is currently available in bookstores. And it is a thriller which I have recently finished, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I highly recommend it. So first of all, David, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Sure, my pleasure.
David, when you started the Camel Club, and as I was reading through it, I was thinking there are a lot of plot twists, there are a lot of things that happen politically. And as you got into the story, did anything happen in the international scene while you were writing it that forced you to take any turns that you hadn't foreseen?
Well, unfortunately not. I mean, I sort of knew where the book was going to be going. And to tell you the truth, as I was writing it, I was, you know, every day reading the newspapers and headlines and CNN and going online to see if things were happening or changing. But, you know, sort of the way I envisioned situations overseas going, I think they stayed on that course and really haven't deviated from it. But I mean, one of the big reasons I wrote Camel Club is that every book written on this subject is always written one way. And we all read books about it, and it's all from one perspective only. And I just got a little tired of that, actually, and just wanted to say, well, you know what, let's take a look at it from another perspective, and let's you know, be truthful about it, and let's try to be accurate about it, and let's try to be commonsensical about it as well. And I also wanted to tell a story about something happening in Washington from a totally different viewpoint. Every book written in Washington about Washington is about powerful people, powerful organizations, powerful agencies. And I wanted to tell a story about people who were not powerful at all, who had no attachments to anyone in power, and seemed to be totally out of the mainstream and have no influence at all, ordinary citizens. But you know what? If they carry through, if they were observant and intelligent and level-headed and had some courage, they actually could have a tremendous impact on things. And that's really where the Camel Club came from.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of the characters I really liked, Oliver Stone, it seemed like you had a lot of fun with that character. He's a great character in the book.
I really did. You know, I worked in Washington since 1986, and my law office was close to the White House, and I would walk there for lunch occasionally. And back then, it was very different. Pennsylvania Avenue was open, and cars and people were walking up and down in front of the White House. And you had Lafayette Park, and you always had these people in Lafayette Park. Some of them have these makeshift tents and their protest signs and all that. And in the back of my mind for years, I'd always thought about these people. I refer to them as permanent White House protesters. And with the Camel Club, I finally decided to write about one of them who was not someone you ever would have thought he would be. And he has really no past. He has this assumed name, Oliver Stone. It was sort of fun to place him with. But he has this cause, this passion. Most people go through life sort of without really a whole lot of passion about something. And he's totally out of the mainstream, and he's not really part of life, but the guy has this passion. He wants to, you know, what's going on. He wants the truth. He wants people to be accountable. And in a way, even though you can look at him and you pass him in the street and you think, my God, this guy's a nut. He's totally crazy. But actually, you know, he has a lot of great moral values and a lot of passion, and he wants to do the right thing, and he wants other people to do the right thing. And he was just a really complex character, but he was a hell of a lot of fun. He really was. I love spending time with Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm. And I will tell the listeners, we're not going to give anything away, but you do get to find out about the Camel Club as the story unfolds. So we're not going to talk about it on the show. But another interesting character I thought was Tom Hemingway.
Yes.
And
you know, Tom Hemingway was one of those. Again, most books written in this genre are very much black and white. You know, there's good and there's evil, and there's really nothing in between. And good is good, and evil is evil, and that's just the way it is. And obviously, of course, we know that's not the way the world works. And with Tom Hemingway, my goal with him was to create a physically imposing and intimidating character who literally could kill you in more ways than you could even think of. But he has more of the heart and soul of a pacifist, I guess I could say. And in this book, I mean, he does some things that you would think, oh my God, they're awful, terrible things. But his motivations are not evil or awful, and they're more altruistic than anything else. But it just turns out in a negative sort of way. But he's the sort of guy that has been shaped by the events of the world and shaped by the career that he's had. Some guys go off the deep end one way or the other. I think with Tom Hemingway, he was a guy who was trying to do the right thing, but used the wrong means to do it. Unfortunately, it's historically relations, but they go about it the wrong way. And there's another character in there, Carter Gray, who he heads up the National Intelligence Center, and that's based on the real life National Intelligence Director. And I sort of have a lot dealing with the sort of revampment of the intelligence community in the United States. But he was very aptly named. I mean, Carter Gray is Carter Gray. And sort of in the middle, through much of the book, you look at what he's doing, and a lot of people will say, thank God that we have a guy like Carter Gray on our side. But then if you look at it from a different point of view, you might start thinking, maybe it's a major liability that we have someone like Carter Gray on our side. But I leave it up to the reader to decide.
At one point, David, you said this about being president. You said, this was the most impossible occupation in history, and in the strange way the world worked, the most coveted.
Yes.
That's very true, isn't it?
It is very true. I mean, think about it. To become president of the United States, one, you have to sort of start working in politics from an early age. You have to build up alliances and allies, and you have to raise an enormous amount of money. You have to allow your life to be subjected to the closest, excruciating scrutiny. You have people gunning for you all the time, painting pictures of you as an evil sort of person. And you do it all for one reason, to attain, you know, the office of the President of the United States. And once you get there, you realize that from day-to-day sort of things, there's very little that you can do or influence, because so many other influences and factors play into this job of governing. Presidents can have great influence in certain areas, but I don't think that's why most people seek the presidency. There is this potency of power in that office that no other job in the world can convey to you. It guarantees you instant immortality, beyond any fame that anyone else could attain. No one will ever forget you if you've been president of the United States. Books will be written about you. Scholars will talk about you for generations to come, long after you're dead. People will still be talking about your name. You'll be listed in books. You'll be in famous places. Your picture will hang in great buildings. It gives you instant and lasting immortality. And I think that's sort of, in many ways, what drives people to seek that office, because it's only a very special breed of people that can do it. And they're all memorable and fascinating in their own way. It's not a job that I would want to have. And I guess that means that I'm just not part of that breed, but that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Early in the book, Captain Jack, one of the characters, says, and good luck trying to change that way of thinking, considering it's been around for thousands of years, talking about the Muslim way of life.
Yes.
And I think in this book you do show an interesting cross-section of life there, here, people that come here, people that live there. And it really is an enormous challenge that we are taking on, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I guess the real issue becomes that democracy in a hurry never works. And democracy by force never works. Democracy, just de facto, is a grassroots, up from the common people sort of system that takes a long time to come about, to be nurtured, to grow in something that's true and lasting. You know, people look at the Muslim world and they think it's all about Islam. And in some ways it is, but in other ways it's not. Long before Islam was a religion, people in Arab countries lived a certain way based on their own topography, geography, resources, or lack thereof. A lot of things that we see in the Middle East right now, the way that people live, are based on tribal customs. They have very little to do with a religious influence, but tribal customs, that's just the way they've always done things. And you see in Afghanistan now, where they've been liberated and Taliban is gone, you still see women, you know, being covered in cloaks and veils. You still see young girls being auctioned off for marriage. Not having anything to do with the influence of the Taliban, but that's just the way that, you know, Afghani tribal customs have worked over the centuries. So it's not just attacking, you know, a religion or trying to defeat a mindset of a Muslim fundamentalist. It's this is a very different part of the world. They have very different customs. And for us to go in and say that we want to change immediately is absurd. I mean, I mentioned in the book talking about America being the freest nation in the world, and arguably we are. But for 250 years, we had slaves. And many people will argue for another 100 years until the Civil Rights Movement. we still had sort of de facto slaves because many of the African Americans lived in segregation and great poverty and, you know, didn't have the freedoms that other people enjoyed. So democracy is a long time in coming in this country, and freedom is a long time in coming in many countries. It's not something you can do overnight. And when you try to do it in a hurry, when you try to do it by force, what you really do is build up this intractable insurgency because, you know, if another country invaded us and wanted to change us, would we just sort of meekly step aside and agree with everything they were doing? No, we would fight like hell. There'd be an underground movement, an insurgency, and we would see what we're seeing now in Iraq. It's just human nature. I think that's one thing that this country sort of miscalculated about. It's human nature to want to fight against someone who's occupying your country and wanting to change you by what they see as force. We would feel the same way, and certainly the Iraqis do. But in the Camel Club, I tried to give you a swath of what I thought were accurate representations. You had fanatics, Muslim fanatics. There certainly are those. You had people who were just normal citizens that were very upset with what had happened to their country, as you or I would be. And then you had some characters who had a very naive outlook about America because they were ignorant about what America really stands for. And then on the flip side, you had Americans thinking they knew all about the Muslim world, and come to find out they knew very little about it. There's ignorance, which leads to intolerance on both sides. And in the Camel Club, I tried to show how easily that can happen, but in order for us to work through it, that ignorance has to come down. It has to be defeated.
Mm-hmm. David, talk to me for a moment, if you would, about, I might be pronouncing the name, Jamila.
Yes.
I thought she was an important part of the book and an interesting look at the way a woman would be used in a terror cell now, which is a change, it seems, from where we were a few years ago. And if you could, tell us a little bit about her and that phenomena of using women now in the terror cells.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost you know, doctors fighting against the bacteria, because bacteria mutates and changes based on antibiotics you dress it with. And the same way in the terrorist community, if the authorities are scrutinizing young Muslim men and subjecting them to searches and investigations and things like that would impede them being able to carry out their missions, then what will you do? Well, you would move to the other gender, and you would have females who, they might still be under some scrutiny, but not nearly as much as the young men, because traditionally they've been the ones who carried out terrorist acts. And that allowed her to move more freely. That allowed her to obtain a job as a nanny for young children. And, you know, many people have foreign-born nannies that care for their kids in this country, and not seem out of the ordinary at all for her to do that. And plus, being a nanny who transports small kids around gave her a perfect cover and a perfect way to sort of elude you know, authorities when the time came for her to do that. So she was the perfect foil and the perfect element in that. But at the same time, when she was working with sort of a larger group of Muslim men, you had to be careful because there are very strict rules about being in the company of women who you don't know, who are not part of your family, you're not married to. And even when you're building sort of this elaborate scheme, I had to keep that in mind and sort of keep her separate from everyone else, which is an interesting element in itself. But she, you know, she gave you sort of a more balanced viewpoint. At times she was conflicted, and I hope the reader is reading about her will be conflicted. At times she was very pessimistic about America and about what it stood for. Then at other times she saw the very human side, and she was happy and laughing and thought it was very nice, but then the gloom would come back again. And that showed sort of, you know, the ignorance of cultures, and that showed that, you know, because we don't know much about each other, that we always have suspicions and we always think the worst of each other. And she was the character through which I had to bring all those emotions out.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was very effective because I did sense, particularly with the children, that she had a concern for them and what was going to happen. And
she really did.
Yeah, and I think maybe with some of the males that get involved, they probably don't feel that way as much.
Right. Right.
David, I will just say to the listeners and the readers, the plot, when it starts moving towards the end, it's breakneck pace, and it is a very, very entertaining read and very satisfying. And do you have to kind of consciously slow yourself down a little bit when you get towards the end as you're writing? I noticed you dedicated, part of the dedication was to Larry Kirschbaum, your editor. And is he helpful to you when you really start going into the final phases of the novel?
Oh, absolutely. So Larry was very instrumental in sort of reading and commenting on the pages, letting me know his thoughts on where he thought the story was going, which characters he thought should be emphasized over other characters. And also, there's a scene at the end when Oliver Stone and his company are at this place, sort of doing battle. And in the initial drafts, I had written it pretty quickly so that it moved through there very fast. And Larry's very astute comment was, you know what, this is such an interesting place, and you've built the story up so much, let it play out. You know, give us more time there. We want to see more of this place. We want to see more of this, you know, the final confrontation. So it went from maybe being, you know, 10 or 15 pages to being 25, 30, 35 pages in length when you read through that final epic confrontation. And so he was very instrumental. And not every word I write is set in stone. I listen to editors, and it's a collaborative process. And I like getting feedback from people because everybody sort of reads things a little bit differently, and I like getting different opinions because as a writer, when you're writing something, you have to sort of understand what emotional reaction you're going to be pulling from your reader because of something that you've written on a page. And if I got 8 or 9 people reading something and telling me 8 or 9 different things, then maybe I'll have to go back and fine-tune until I sort of know what people are going to be pulling from those pages. And Larry was certainly instrumental in helping me do that. And two, you know, looking back over the initial draft, I wanted it to linger as well. I wanted it to sort of, it took 300-odd pages to get you to the first epic confrontation in this book. And then when everybody I know who's going to read this book will think on that day in that small town, they know exactly what's going to happen. And when it happens, they still think they know exactly what's happened. But then 10 or 15 pages later, everything gets blown away. And they know they were totally and completely wrong about what was actually going to happen. And then the reader realizes after this climax, they have 120 pages left to go.
Yeah.
And in that last 120 pages, my job as a writer was to somehow ratchet up the stakes even more. I did it in a way. I used a device that I think you can't go any higher than the stakes are at the end of this book. That's the penultimate. That's it. There's no place else to go. And made it a sort of a countdown situation. And that's where everybody's, you know, looking back and forth. You're at one location, then you're back at the ticking clock. Then you're at that location again, you're back at the ticking clock. And it, for me, reading it over and over again, I never was not excited reading those pages. I really wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very effective. David, thank you so much for your time today. Looking back on the Camel Club, which is published by Warner Books, now available in your bookstores, what is it you're happiest about with this novel, would you say?
Well, I think what I'm happiest about is that most novels in my genre, and most people who write fiction do it to entertain people, I think that I've succeeded in writing an entertaining book. I think that I've succeeded in writing a very informative book. And I hope and I think that I've succeeded in writing a book that made people think about things that maybe they might not have thought about before. And if you entertain, if you inform, and you make people think, then you can't ask any more of a book or of a writer. And I think I've accomplished that in the Camel Club.
Great. I agree completely. Our guest today has been David Baldacci. We've been discussing The Camel Club, currently in bookstores by Warner Books. And David, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.